This is Hidden Killers Half Year in Review. A look back at some of the most compelling cases of 2026 so far. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Maureen Brainerd Barnes told her friend she needed to make $3,000 that weekend. She was facing eviction. If she lost her apartment, she could lose custody of her children. So on July 9th of 2007, the 25-year-old mother of two took the Amtrak from New London, Connecticut to Grand Central Terminal in Manhattan to do what she'd done before. Work as an escort for a few days, earn enough money to hold things together, and take the train home. Her friend Sarah Carnes was with her. They checked into the Super 8 Motel on West 46th Street in Midtown and started seeing clients. On Monday night, Sarah decided to call it quits and head back to Connecticut. Maureen said she wanted to stay until Wednesday. She had a client lined up for that night, an out call, meaning she'd be going to meet him somewhere outside the motel. At 11:43 p.m., Maureen called a friend in Connecticut. That's the last confirmed contact anyone had with her. She never made it back to Norwich. She never made it back to her children. People who love Maureen describe her in ways that have nothing to do with how she died. They talk about her songwriting, her art, her romantic streak. Her sister, Melissa Cann, calls her a dreamer. Friends remember someone creative and warm, someone who saw beauty in the world, even when her own circumstances were squeezing her from every direction. Maureen was a mother first. That's the detail that matters more than anything else in understanding why she was in Manhattan that July weekend. She had children at home. She was fighting to keep them, and the financial pressures bearing down on her, the eviction threat, the custody risk, drove her to a decision that millions of people in impossible situations make every day. She chose the option that was available. She went to work. Maureen was petite, 4 feet 11, 105 pounds. She advertised under names Juliana and Marie on Craigslist and Backpage. Her routine was consistent. She'd travel to Manhattan for a few days, book a room at one of the regular hotels, the Super 8, the Red Roof Inn on West 32nd, the Carter Hotel on West 43rd, the Manhattan Hotel on 8th Avenue, and work from there. Sometimes she traveled with another woman who worked out of a separate room at the same location. They sometimes brought a male friend along for safety, someone they'd refer to as their cousin. It was a system, not a glamorous one, not a safe one, but a system designed to manage the risks as best they could. On the weekend she disappeared, Maureen traveled with Sarah, but Sarah left on Monday. Maureen stayed behind, and on the night of July 9th, she told her friend about an out call. She was going to meet someone outside the motel, and she didn't come back. Maureen wasn't reported missing until July 14th, 5 days later. And the report wasn't filed in New York, where she'd actually disappeared. It was filed by a friend with the Norwich Police Department in Connecticut, because that's where Maureen lived. The NYPD eventually took over the case, but by then, whatever trail existed had gone cold. In the universe of missing persons, Maureen's disappearance was quiet. No public outcry, no media campaign, no pressure on investigators to move faster. She was an S worker who'd gone to a city and hadn't come home. And in 2007, that kind of disappearance didn't generate the attention it should have. But here's what was happening with Maureen's phone. 3 days after she vanished, her cell phone was used in Suffolk County along the Long Island Expressway to place two outgoing calls. Her phone in someone else's hands, picking off cell towers in a highway that leads to and from Gilgo Beach. The calls weren't to anyone in Maureen's known contacts. They were outbound calls from a phone that should have been in the possession of a woman who was already dead or dying. When investigators began building the Gilgo Beach case years later, the cell phone forensics became a cornerstone of the prosecution. Prosecutors alleged that Rex Hewerman, used prepaid burner phones to contact his victims, a different burner for each woman, discarded after each killing. But prosecutors also alleged he did something else. He accessed the victims' phones after their disappearances. In Maureen's case, according to court filings, Hewerman allegedly checked her voicemail after she was gone. After whatever was done to her was done, he allegedly reached into her digital life to listen to her messages. Think about what that implies. It's not just about evidence. Prosecutors have argued that this behavior goes beyond operational security. It suggests someone who wanted to remain connected to the aftermath, someone who derived something from the continuation of the victim's digital presence even after the person was gone. Law enforcement officials involved in the case have described this as consistent with the psychology of a sadistic predator, someone for whom the killing itself is the only phase of the experience. The burner phone data is what eventually led investigators to what they called the box, a small cluster of cell towers, coverage areas within Massapequa Park, where multiple burner phones connected to multiple victims had pinged. Working with the FBI in 2012, investigators mapped the overlap and identified a radius of just a few blocks. Every burner phone that had been used to contact the Gilgo 4 traced back to that same tiny area, the box. And inside the box, on a quiet residential block, lived an architect named Rex Huerman. Maureen was the first of the Gilgo 4 to disappear in July 2007. The next was Melissa Barthelemy in July 2009, then Megan Waterman in June 2010, then Amber Costello in September of 2010. A pattern separated by months and years, but united by the same geography, the same cell towers, the same corridors, the same stretch of Ocean Parkway, where all of them ended up. And Maureen waited the longest. Her remains are recovered on December 13, 2010, wrapped in burlap on the north side of Ocean Parkway near Gilgo Beach alongside Megan Waterman and Amber Costello, all found within days of Melissa Barthelemy's discovery on December 11th. The four women were within a quarter mile of each other in the brush, all bound, all in burlap, three wrapped in tape, one bound with belts. All petite, all in their 20s, all S-workers who advertised online, all found because a police officer named John Malia took his cadaver dog to a stretch of highway he selected based on FBI data about where dumped bodies tend to turn up. Maureen had been gone for more than 3 years. 3 Christmases, 3 birthdays, 3 years of her children growing up without her, and nobody knowing where she was. Maureen was charged against Huerman separately from the initial 3 victims. When he was arrested in July of 23, he was charged with the murders of Barthelemy, Waterman, and Costello, the 3 cases where the DNA evidence was strongest at that point. Maureen was named as one of the victims, and he is the prime suspect later. And in January 24, a grand jury handed down a superseding indictment, adding second-degree murder in her death. At that hearing, Maureen's family spoke publicly for the first time. Her sister, Melissa Cann, stood in front of cameras and described a woman the public had never gotten to know. "It has been 16 years since the last time I saw my sister," Cann said. "16 years since I heard her voice, because 16 years ago she was silenced." She described Maureen as a loving mother, a sister, a friend. And then she said something that cut through the courtroom. Maureen would never get the chance to show the world how talented she was. A songwriter, an artist, a romantic, a mother of 2, who rode the Amtrak to Manhattan because the rent was due and the custody hearing was coming and she was out of time. That's who Maureen Brainerd Barnes was. And none of that appeared in the case file for over a decade. And then there was Nicolette. Nicolette Brainerd Barnes was 7 years old when her mother was killed. She grew up without Maureen. She navigated childhood, adolescence, and early adulthood carrying a weight that no 7-year-old should ever have to pick up. At the indictment hearing, Nicolette spoke as an adult, composed, deliberate, and devastated. "While the loss of my mom has been extremely painful for me," she said, The indictment by the grand jury has brought hope for justice for my mom and my family. She was 7. She's now an adult. The entirety of her conscious life has been shaped by her mother's murder, by the absence, the unanswered questions, the years of waiting for a name to be attached to the person who took Maureen away. And until Huerman's arrest, Nicolette didn't have that. None of the families did. Prosecutors allege that every murder Huerman is charged with occurred while his wife and children were out of state. His family's travel schedule allegedly became his operational window. When they left, according to the prosecution's theory, Huerman used the empty house in Massapequa Park, the house his own children grew up in, as the staging ground for what he allegedly did. He'd buy a burner phone, he'd contact a victim, he'd allegedly lure her or him to go out to meet her, and then his family would come home, and life would resume. He allegedly searched for information about the investigation. He allegedly looked up the victims' families, their sisters, their children. He was allegedly tracking the aftermath of his own crimes while sitting in the same house where his daughter did homework. Maureen Brainerd Barnes went to Manhattan because she was out of options. She was trying to keep her apartment. She was trying to keep her children. She was trying to do what parents do when the safety net doesn't exist. You improvise, you take the work that's available. You ride the train to the city and check into the Super 8 and hope that this weekend's earnings will buy you another month of stability. According to prosecutors, the man she allegedly encountered on the night of July 9th, 2007 had a system of his own. Burner phones, checklists, an empty house and a truck and a stretch of highway where he allegedly knew no one would look. A system designed, according to the evidence prosecutors have presented, to exploit exactly the vulnerability that brought Maureen to Manhattan that weekend. Her friend Sarah Carnes, who was with Maureen that weekend, has spoken about the guilt of leaving early, about the calls she made after Maureen stopped answering, about the way the worry started slow and then hit like a wall. I started losing faith when more of her kids' birthdays passed, Carnes said. More Christmases passed. Maureen was a songwriter who never got to finish her songs, a mother who was fighting to hold her family together, a woman who called her friend at 11:43 on a Monday night and said she had to be somewhere. She was 25 years old. She's 4'11", and she was brave enough to walk into a situation that terrified her because her kids needed her to be. That's not how she deserves to be remembered. But it is the truth of what happened. And the truth is that the system that should have protected Maureen Brainerd Barnes, the one that should have noticed a mother was missing, that should have moved faster, that should have connected the dots before 3 more women disappeared, that system failed her in every way a system can fail a person. Her daughter grew up without her. Her sister waited 16 years for accountability, and Maureen's voice, songwriter, the dreamer, the romantic, has been silent since July 9th of 2007. It shouldn't have taken this long for someone to answer for it. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. If you're liking our reporting, please press subscribe wherever you are watching us or listening to us. YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it may be. Maybe more than one place. Take us with you wherever you go. And hit that subscribe button right now so you don't miss any of it. We'll continue our conversation in the comment section. Like I said, on Substack and YouTube, the links are in the description. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
A 15-year-old girl's phone rings. The number on the screen is her sister's, but the voice on the other end isn't Melissa. It's a man. He doesn't identify himself. He tells Amanda things about Melissa's worth, work, about the kind of person she is. The language is vulgar, mocking, designed to wound. The call lasts less than 3 minutes. It comes from a crowded public location in Manhattan near Madison Square Garden, where surveillance cameras are useless in a sea of anonymous faces. Over the next 5 weeks, the calls keep coming from Times Square, from Midtown, always under 3 minutes, always targeting Amanda, never Melissa's mother, who the caller hung up on when she tried to answer. Each call is more explicit than the last. In the final one, the man tells Amanda that her sister is dead, that he killed her, and that he's going to watch her rot. Amanda Funderburg was 15 years old. She was the only member of Melissa's family who knew her sister was working as an escort. And someone who had access to Melissa's phone after her disappearance chose this teenager as the target of a sustained psychological campaign. Not the police, not the mother, not a friend, a child. The youngest, most vulnerable person in the family. That choice tells you something about whoever made those calls. It tells you this wasn't just about killing. It was about the experience that came after. Melissa Barthelemy was born on April 14th, 1985 in Buffalo, New York. She grew up there, graduated high school in 03, earned her cosmetology license, and started working at a Supercuts in her hometown. She was good at it. She liked making people look better. Her dream was to move to New York City, work at a high-end salon, and eventually own her own place. That's the version of the future Melissa saw for herself. A hairstylist with her own chair, her own business, her own name on the door. She moved to the city, and reality hit the way it does. The salon job didn't materialize immediately. She ended up renting a basement apartment on Underhill Avenue in Tremont, a Bronx neighborhood, for $700 a month. Her landlady, Bella Mia, thought Melissa was working in cosmetology, but the city is expensive, and the salon career was moving slow. And at some point, Melissa started stripping, and she started picking up escort work through Craigslist, advertising under the alias Chloe. Her family back in Buffalo knew about the dancing. Amanda knew about the escorting. Nobody else did. Melissa's parents, Lynn Barthelemy, worked at Lynn Barthelemy and Mark Sispola, worried about their daughter in the city. But they knew she was stubborn and capable. She was 4'10", 95 pounds, and everyone who knew her described her the same way, a spitfire, fierce, independent, not someone who backed down. Mia, her landlady, described Melissa as a sweet girl, a good tenant. She kept to herself. She had 8 cats. She never brought clients to the apartment. Whatever Melissa was doing to survive, she kept it contained. She kept it away from where she lived. She was managing a double life with the precision of someone who understood the stakes. On the evening of July 12th, 2009, Melissa told a friend she was going to meet a man. Earlier that day, she deposited $900 in her bank account. A good day's earnings. She tried to call an ex-boyfriend, but he didn't answer. Those are the last known acts of Melissa Barthelemy's life. A bank deposit, an unanswered phone call, and a mention to a friend that she had somewhere to be. Her mother reported her missing 6 days later, on July 18th, after not hearing from her, which was unusual. Melissa stayed in touch with her family, even if she kept them at arm's length from the specifics of her work. And then the calls started. Law enforcement officials who investigated the phone calls described the caller as emotionally flat, monotone, controlled. Former Suffolk County Police Commissioner Richard Dormer said the calls were extremely descriptive and sadistic in tone. The caller spoke only to Amanda. But Melissa's mother, Lynn, tried to answer. He hung up. When Amanda picked up, he stayed on the line, but never for more than 3 minutes. Investigators later noted that police typically need 3 minutes to pinpoint a cell phone's location. The caller apparently knew that. He kept each conversation just short enough to prevent a trace. The calls came from some of the most crowded public spaces in Manhattan, Madison Square Garden, Times Square, places where even if investigators rushed to the scene, and they did, the density of foot traffic made it impossible to identify anyone. The NYPD and FBI were actively trying to locate the caller in real time. They failed. Whoever was making these calls understood law enforcement's limitations and was exploiting them deliberately. The content of the calls escalated over the five-week period. Early on, the caller described Melissa's work, called her degraded names, told Amanda things designed to humiliate the family. As the weeks progressed, the language became more explicit, more threatening, more designed to cause maximum psychological damage. Police officials who reviewed the calls described them as methodical, not the product of someone calling in a panic or acting on impulse, but someone who had a purpose. The caller was choosing his words. He was choosing his timing. He was choosing his target. A 15-year-old girl who had no power to do anything except listen and absorb what she was hearing. And the fact that he hung up on Melissa's mother tells you something critical. He didn't want to talk to an adult. He didn't want a conversation with someone who might push back, ask questions, or maintain composure. He wanted the person most likely to be devastated, confused, and afraid. That's not incidental. According to behavioral analysis who have reviewed the case, that's predatory targeting, the extension of violence from the physical act into the psychological aftermath. The killing didn't end the experience for this caller. It opened a new phase. Some investigators speculated at the time the caller might have a background in law enforcement, given the apparent knowledge of tracing protocols and location strategy. But the prosecution's case offers a different explanation. According to prosecutors, Hierman had over 200 Google searches related to the Gilgo Beach investigation on his devices. He was allegedly researching how the case was being investigated while the investigation was underway. If the caller was Hierman, and the cell phone evidence prosecutors have laid out strongly suggests that it was, then the operational awareness wasn't professional training. It was research, homework, self-education on how to avoid being caught. The cell phone forensics are among the strongest pieces of evidence in the Barthelemy case. Prosecutors allege that on the day Melissa disappeared, a burner phone she'd connected with for the appointment traveled from Massapequa Park, where Hierman lived, to Midtown Manhattan, where he worked. The routine mirrors his daily commute exactly. Hours later, Melissa's own phone traveled the same route in reverse, from Manhattan back toward Long Island, toward Massapequa Park, towards a house prosecutors say became the center of the operation. That phone trail doesn't just suggest contact. It suggests a journey. Melissa's phone, and by implication, Melissa herself, allegedly traveled from Manhattan to Long Island on the night she disappeared, following the exact route between Hierman's office and his home. According to prosecutors, his wife and children were out of state at that time. More than a year passed. Melissa's cats meowed and scratched at the door at her Bronx apartment until her landlady noticed. Bellamia hadn't seen her tenant in days, then weeks. The cats were hungry. The apartment was silent. Mia contacted authorities, but by then whatever trail might have existed had gone cold. The case joined the growing pile of missing women in New York City. Women who disappeared without explanation and whose cases didn't generate the kind of public pressure that forces investigators to prioritize. Nobody found her. Nobody identified a suspect. The case went quiet. Then on December 11th, 2010, a Suffolk County police officer named John Malia took his cadaver dog, Blue, on a training exercise along Ocean Parkway near Gilgo Beach. Lee had chosen the location based on FBI data indicating that bodies are frequently discovered near roadways. Despite thick vegetation and a light layer of snow, Blue alerted to a scent. Lee followed the dog to a skeleton wrapped in disintegrated burlap. Melissa Barthelemy. The first of the Gilgo Four to be found, not because anyone was looking for her, because a training exercise happened to take place in the right spot. Within days, three more sets of remains were discovered within a quarter mile. Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Megan Waterman, Amber Costello, The search for Shannon Gilbert, a missing escort from Oak Beach, had expanded to this stretch of highway, and what they found there transformed a missing person case into the most significant serial killer investigation on the East Coast in decades. Melissa was wrapped in burlap and bound, consistent with the other Gilgo 4 victims. She'd been there for over a year, through an entire summer, a fall, a winter, a few hundred yards from a highway where cars passed daily, her body reduced to a skeleton in the salt air and dense brush of Long Island's South Shore. DNA from a toothbrush found in her Bronx apartment confirmed the identification. Her family finally had an answer, but not the one they wanted. When Hiraman was arrested in July of 23, the evidence prosecutors presented, including the cell phone data, the burner phone patterns, and something else. Allegations that Hiraman didn't just stalk his victims before their deaths. Prosecutors allege he stalked their families afterwards. His internet search history, according to court filings, included not just information about the Gilgo Beach investigation and torture material. It also included searches for images of the victims and their family members, their sisters, their children. He allegedly researched the very people grieving the women he was charged with killing, looking at their photos, locating them. And if true, that behavior goes beyond the act of murder and into a sustained, ongoing engagement with the suffering left behind. The phone calls to Amanda, the alleged monitoring of the families, the voicemail checks on victims' phones. According to the prosecution's theory, Hiraman didn't just kill these women, he allegedly fed off the wake of destruction that followed. Melissa Barthelemy moved to New York City to do hair. She wanted to work at a salon. She wanted her own place. She wanted the version of New York that promises reinvention. The one that says, if you're talented enough, if you work hard enough, you can build something from nothing here. She was talented. She was hardworking. She was 4 feet 10 and fearless. And the economic reality of the city pushed her into a space where she became vulnerable to someone prosecutors describe as a predator who methodically targeted women in exactly that kind of vulnerability. She came from Buffalo. She graduated from cosmetology school. She had 8 cats in a basement apartment in the Bronx. Her sister Amanda, who was 15 when those phone calls started, has carried the weight of what she heard on those calls for the rest of her life. Melissa deserved the salon. She deserved the chair with her name on it. She deserved to be 24 in a city that rewarded her ambition instead of exploiting her circumstances. She deserved to grow old enough to look back on the Bronx apartment and the Craigslist ad as a chapter she survived, not one that ended her. What she got instead was a man who, according to prosecutors, used a burner phone, followed a commute route, and then allegedly picked up her own phone and called a teenager to describe what he'd done. That's not a killer who operates in the shadows and disappears. That's someone who, if prosecutors are right, wanted an audience for the cruelty. And he chose a 15-year-old girl. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love for you to weigh in. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching us. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever it may be, so you don't miss any of our reporting. We'll continue our conversation there in the comments. Until then, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something, but I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public would be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.